support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT, presenting Stephen Sondheim's rapturous musical, A Little Night Music. Featuring an all-star cast, A Little Night Music begins performances at ACT's Geary Theater May 20th. ACT-SF.org.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Kristen Valdez-Quaid remembers living in trailers and tents around the Southwest following her geologist father from one dig site to the next. In her debut short story collection, Night at the Fiestas, she draws on her nomadic childhood and explores the fragile line between sin and redemption. A former Stegner Fellow and a Capote Fellow at Stanford University, she received an Under 35 Award from the National Book Foundation, and her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Narrative, and The Best American Short Stories. She presently is a visiting professor at the University of Michigan. She joins us in studio for this Forum segment, and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you, and glad to know that you were a longtime Forum listener when you were at Stanford. That's always exciting to hear, and also excited about the stories that you have produced here in your debut collection, which really, this is what I call journeyman work, if that word were not so sexist. Maybe you should call it journey person work or something along those lines, because it's a very impressive debut collection of short stories, and I want to talk about them and talk about what's in them. And let's talk first about New Mexico, because that's your territory, that's your landscape. And, of course, I think always of George O'Keefe, or I think of Leslie Marmon Silko, but I think now you've put a different stamp on it.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yes, I mean, New Mexico is where my mother's family's from. They've been there for hundreds of years since the Spanish conquistadors. And it's all I was born in Albuquerque. And as a child, I spent a lot of time with my older relatives, my great grandmother and my grandparents. And so I've always been felt very connected to that history. And their childhoods have always felt, through their stories, to be just out of reach, almost within reach, but just out of reach. And I think I was interested in my place and in that history because of the time I spent with
my grandparents. You got a lot of good material from your family.
I was very lucky in that regard.
Well, there are stories. I mean, I mentioned, for example, your father was a geologist, and there's a story about a geologist who plays a smaller role than the mother and her daughter. And yet there's also a central story here. The first story, is one, not the title story, but the first story about an event that I think came out of your actual biographical circumstances, a murder, a killing, yeah?
It did, yes. The story is called Nemesia, and it's the seed for that story really is in something that happened to my godmother when she was a child. She was hiding behind a wood box and watched as her father, in a drunken rage, killed her grandfather, who was also my grandmother's grandfather, and put her mother in a coma. And this was a story that I didn't know about until after my godmother died. It was a family secret. And, you know, I'd known my godmother. I loved my godmother. She was really vivacious and glamorous. She was a ballroom dancer in LA for much of her career. I got a lot of her hand-me-downs, so, you know, these ratty old fur stoles. And she had this blonde hair that was blown up really high and stiff. And it was, I never really understood that she was related to us by blood. I had no idea that her first language had been Spanish. I had no idea that she'd grown up in the same small town that my grandmother grew up in. And all of this came out after she passed away. And I was stunned by this, to think that somebody I had known well and loved had experienced a trauma like that, and a trauma that had really shaped her life.
What you did with this trauma, though, was pretty amazing. You turned it into a young girl thinking that she had been the killer, this young girl who hides in the story and who takes that responsibility upon herself, being a five-year-old child.
And I think, you know, that is all fiction. And that's where the fiction really came into it, because I was trying to explore for myself what it would be like to have witnessed something like that and to have had to forget about it. And I think she did, on some level, forget about it in her life. She never spoke of it. Nobody around her ever spoke of it. But I felt that trauma would have had to have stayed with her. And so that's where fiction and imagination really came into it, because I asked my grandmother a lot of stories that my grandmother, I mean, a lot of questions that my grandmother really couldn't answer for me about what it had been like for my godmother.
Or maybe wouldn't want to answer to.
That's possible.
Well,
very possible.
That's where the imagination comes into play. And I mean, this becomes a story really about two young women, two girls really, who are like siblings for the most mm-hmm. part. One is a cousin, but she goes to live with. And then the younger girl goes to live with her family. And so there's that kind of non-nuclear extended family that's still biologically mm-hmm. aligned. But the real focus of the story is somewhat of the love, rivalry, and difficulties between these two girls, one of them becoming more assimilated, one of them not. And what I was struck by there was how you get into the ambivalence in so many relationships, the sense of particularly siblings. I know you have siblings, but the difficulties with respect to loving in an unfettered way one sibling and accepting one sibling, and yet having all of these feelings underneath the surface.
You know, I think the nuclear family is, to me, the most fascinating terrain for fiction, because there's something about, you know, that particular love that members of a family have for each other, and also this really sort of keen ability to wound, and some, you know, often unintentionally. But, you know, I do think that small injuries in a nuclear family can loom really large. And I'm interested in that tension. I'm interested in the way that members of a family, you know, nobody knows how to push your buttons like your siblings.
Well, except maybe your parents or spouse or a significant other. But speaking of wounds, I mean, there's a story in here also about five wounds. And Catholicism plays an important role, especially ritual and processions and things of that sort in your work. And I was wondering about this story, because it's a man who decides, a not very estimable man, who decides that he wants to go through the pageant of being crucified like Christ. Do you actually witness one of those?
You know, I haven't live. I haven't witnessed one live. Penitentes are a community that has been in northern New Mexico. It's a way of practicing Catholicism that's been there since the Spanish. It traces its roots back to medieval Spain, with, you know, self-flagellation. And
it's a lot of foreign countries, like the Philippines, one sees this, but not so much in the States. Yeah.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, there are these pockets, isolated pockets of northern New Mexico that really... where that has still existed. And for much of the 20th century, it was pushed underground. At the beginning of the 20th century, there would be often reporters, Anglo reporters from back east, who would come to New Mexico and report on these religious rites and frame these people as zealots and, you know, nutty. And so as a result of that, the practice really went underground for much of the 20th century. And it's always been, I've always found it tremendously moving. To me, as a way of worship, it feels like it's the closest thing to empathy, really trying to feel, you know, walking the Via Dolorosa, the path of sorrow, and, you know, trying to feel what Christ felt as he was being whipped. And so I've always found that to be tremendously moving. And I was interested in that and in the line between this sort of empathetic practice and the pageantry of it, because it's a performance on some level.
And when you mention empathy, of course, I can't help but be prompted to how, on a number of occasions, I believe you've said in interviews and in other instances, that empathy has a great deal to do with why you write. I mean, you write as a risk taker, you said. You also write really to feel what other people are feeling.
You know, I think I've always been so curious about other people's experiences. And writing for me feels like, you know, it's like playing make-believe and pretend. You get to, for the space of a story, you get to walk in somebody else's shoes. And, you know, for me, that's really the greatest pleasure of reading is having the opportunity to experience other lives. I mean, I think reading and writing fiction is the closest we can get to living other lives and experiencing other people's experiences.
Well, you do it quite well, if I may say so. And Catholicism does play a central role in many of your stories. In fact, I was also reading an interview where you mentioned a couple of writers who were of great influence on you, Alice Munro and Flannery O'Connor, writers I admire very much. And do you look like O'Connor did at all for grace in your characters or for some sense of finding grace?
I do. I mean, she is such a strong influence on me. O'Connor and I come from different places.
Georgia and New Mexico, never the twain shall meet.
Exactly. So also just different relationships to religion. She was absolutely a believer. And I think I write about religion because I am always wondering what role it plays in my life. That's something that I've always been interested in, trying to figure it out. I am a geologist's daughter, and I had a poster of the evolution of man on my wall when I was a kid. And I could identify Australopithecine skulls. And yet I also had this strong Catholic influence from my grandmother in particular, and really loved going to Mass with her, loved being in processions with her. She was in the Altar Society for many, many years at the cathedral.
Did you ever get dressed up like an angel, like in your opening story, in one of those processions? Or
I never got to be an angel. I got to be the Virgin Mary once. That was a proud moment. That story about the angel wings, though, comes directly from my grandmother. My grandmother remembers her mother every year for the Feast of Corpus Christi sewing all the little girls new white dresses, and they got to wear these gauzy angel wings.
There's also a character named Angel in the Five Wounds, a daughter who is 14 years old and pregnant. But maybe could I have you read from that story, perhaps? This is, again, from the collection Night at the Fiestas, by our guest, Kristen Valdez-Quaid.
Yes, I'd be happy to. So this is the very opening of The Five Wounds. This year, Amadeo Padilla is Jesus. The hermanos have been practicing in the dirt yard behind the Morada, which used to be a filling station. People are saying that Amadeo is the best Jesus they've had in years, maybe the best since Manuel Garcia. Here it is, just Holy Tuesday, and even those who would rather spend the evening at home watching their satellite TVs are lined up in the alley, leaning in, fingers curled around the chain link, because they can see that Amadeo is bringing something special to the role. This is no silky-haired, rosy-cheeked, honey-eyed Jesus, no Jesus of the children, Jesus with the lambs. Amadeo is pockmarked and bad-toothed, hair shaved close to a scalp scarred from fights, roll of skin where skull meets thick neck. You name the sin, he's done it.
That does give us a pretty vivid picture of Amadeo. And you mentioned Manuel Garcia in this reading. That becomes a rivalry in the story that's also a part. A lot of these, like I said, sibling rivalries, but a lot of other kind of rivalries as well. Again, we're talking to Kristen Valdez-Quaid, whose book Night at the Fiestas is out and available. And she was a Stegner Fellow and a Jones Lecturer at Stanford, and has taught writing as a visiting professor at University of Michigan. We're going to invite listeners to join us, and we're talking about writing, too, and the just what writing does for people. In many cases, let me read something that you said. You were talking about faith, actually, because we've been talking about Catholicism, too, and you said faith is about longing for transcendence, to be closer to the infinite and to connect with others. It's about empathy. And you go on to say that writing fiction is really about empathy and longing, or longing and empathy. Anyway, let's hear what our listeners have to say. And some of you may have read the work in Narrative or in The New Yorker that Kristen has published. It's very impressive work, I must say. And it must have been a real high when you were accepted into The New Yorker.
Oh my gosh, it was absolutely thrilling. I didn't believe it for a couple days, and it took some time for me to accept that the email was true.
Well, let me invite listeners to join the program again. Our toll-free number is available to you, and it's 866-733-6786. If you'd like to talk about writing, Catholicism, rivalry and relationships, things we've brought up here in the course of this interview, but other things that you may indeed want to discuss are open for discussion. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum. And just click on this segment. Fiction has to be emotionally risky, you say.
I think so. I think, you know, there's occasionally when I'm writing, I will come upon something and maybe a character will be having an ugly thought, and occasionally I'll feel really uneasy with what I'm writing, and I'll think, God, I don't want anybody to ever know that this thought occurred to me. And usually when I have that feeling, that's a sign that I'm getting to something interesting in the story.
Or maybe even authentic, yeah. Didn't your grandmother read your story and say you were a busybody?
Well, yes, I mean, because I'm always peppering her for questions about what it was like to be a child growing up in Torreon, New Mexico, and, you know, what her life has been like. And so she frequently calls me an entrometida, which is, you know, nosy and interfering. She read when my story got in the New Yorker, I called my first story, The Five Wounds, her a little, you know, soon after it came out, and I had sent her a copy, and I asked her if she read it, and she said, yes, I did. And then and I said, so what did you think? And she said, oh, mi hijita, I didn't know you knew so many bad words. But she's been very, very lovely and supportive of the stories, even the ones like Nemesia that use sort of sensitive family material that I think she would probably rather I not write about. But she's been generous in that regard.
How old is your abuela?
She would kill me for saying how old she is. She's in her 80s.
That's my guess. Let me get a caller on here. I think a former student of yours, Jacqueline. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Kristen. This is Jacqueline Genovese from your Stanford class.
Oh, Jacqueline, it's so lovely to hear from you.
And I just want to go on record officially to say what a fantastic teacher Kristen is. Creative writing.
It's actually Irene keeps reminding me.
I answer to everything. Jacqueline, that is so kind of you. Thank you.
And congratulations. I'm so happy for you.
Oh.
I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about Catholicism and maybe any of the potentially negative influences or shaping that may have had for you.
Well, you know, I mean, I can't say that I have actually had any really negative experiences with Catholicism. And part of it is that, you know, in my childhood and also adulthood, I haven't attended Mass regularly. I, you know, sort of dip in and out. I did spend, I guess maybe the most negative experience I've had with it is that when I was in third grade, I went to the cathedral school in Santa Fe, and the locks on the bathroom stalls didn't work very well. And one day I opened the, and I was brand new to the school, and I opened the stall, and there was a nun in this bathroom stall. And I was so stunned and so shocked. I didn't understand that nuns actually went to the bathroom. And I just froze there. And then she said, shut the door. And that was a terrifying moment for me. You know, honestly, though, my experience of Catholicism really is so closely linked to my close relationship to my grandmother and, you know, lighting candles at her altar and, you know, reciting prayers before bed with her, going with her to the cathedral and collecting the linens from the altar. It feels deeply connected to my relationship with her and also to my sense of family history. At points in my life, we attended church regularly, but...
Would you call yourself a fallen away Catholic then, or somewhat fallen away?
I don't know what I would call myself. I mean, I consider myself Catholic, but I suspect that maybe other people might not consider me to be a good Catholic.
Well, in the Five Wounds story, there's a sacred space. It happens to be in a filling station, though. What do you call this, a Murata? And women are not allowed. The main character takes his daughter in there. And I'm just wondering about this idea of the sacred or... I mean, first of all, was that actually drawn from life, a filling station with a sacred space?
No, and in fact, that was sort of very, very, very... I was determined to fictionalize in that moment because it was important to me that I differentiate the Hermanidad and the Morada that I was writing about in that story from these non-fictional sacred spaces. So I actually don't know of any Moradas that are in old filling stations. In northern New Mexico, they're very beautiful.
It's kind of an appropriate metaphor, though, I suppose, for some people, the people you're writing about.
I guess so. And, you know, I think in that story, I was really interested, again, in, you know, the tension between the pageantry and the very personal experience of religion and the tension between the sacred and the profane, the sort of everyday life. I mean, my character wants to be Jesus. He wants to transcend, you know, his own flawed, broken life where he's made terrible mistakes. And yet, you know, even if he does the best performance ever and, you know, asks for the nails and gets himself up on the cross, still the next day he wakes up in his own life, in his own skin, and has to deal with that.
His own skin wounded, however, from the crucifixion. There is a sense, though, of you're struggling maybe as a writer with the whole question of what redemption is or how one finds redemption. Do you believe in redemption? I mean, I'm going right to your faith here. How much behind it?
I do believe in redemption. I mean, I think that's sort of the job of every human is to...
But there's human redemption and then there's divine redemption. And they are separate in most people's minds, even people of faith.
You know, and I don't actually know if I believe in divine redemption. That is one of the questions that I deal with a lot.
Yes.
And I've always questioned. I do firmly believe that if there is divine redemption, if there is a divine, that it is through our relationships on earth, the relationships that we have control over, that we can get closest to that.
Also, getting back to writing, you've said on a couple of occasions that you write into uncertainty. What do you mean by that?
Well, on a very basic level, I never know what a story is going to be about when I start it. I never have any idea. And really, the process of writing for me is figuring that out. It's spending time with the characters and seeing where they lead me. It's trying different events, putting different events and different pressures into the story to see what happens. You know, I think I generally start with a character in a situation and then some kind of mystery, some kind of question that I am writing to answer.
There's O'Connor again, you know, moving into mystery or
yeah.
Trying to understand mystery. But even a character like Amadeo, who, as you said in the passage you read, you name the sin and he's done it. Nevertheless, you feel not only empathy for him, but maybe even love?
I do, absolutely. I mean, I love all my characters. You know, I don't think a writer can spend, well, I won't speak for all writers. I couldn't spend as much time as I have to spend with these characters, you know, to get a story to completion without growing to love them. And Amadeo was a very difficult character for me to to get to love. Yes. I did not like him in the beginning. And that was a major problem with early drafts. I was judgmental. I disliked him. I wanted him punished for being, you know, he was abusive. He was an alcoholic. He had completely dropped the ball on his parenthood of his child.
Yeah, I was going to say, he was a deadbeat dad.
Yeah.
There aren't many things to like there. But you embody these characters and you get to love them in that sense, get inside their skin, literally.
And it took me, again, with that guy, it took me a long time. You know, I have some characters who are easier to get to know and to, for me to love. He took some time.
So what about getting into, for example, a real villain, writing a character like Iago or something like that? Do you think you have that capability too? Embodying that kind of person?
I'd like to. I don't think I could ever write Iago. That's such a brilliant, brilliant character, you know, created by a brilliant writer. But I am so interested in flawed people. I mean, flawed people are always more interesting than perfect people. And, you know, I've been told that my characters are, that I write characters who can be unlikable. And I don't really think that it's important that characters be likable necessarily. I think it's important that they be interesting. And I think it's important that I, as a writer, show the reader what is human about those characters and try to make that the character feel believable and feel true. But yeah, you know, I have characters in this book who are angry and selfish and, you know, unpleasant. And I hope over the course of the story that I have opened some window for change for them.
Now that's the key. That's the important thing. And I want to get a caller in from Oakland before we have to say goodbye to you. Sharon, join us. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask Kirsten, I have similar family background. My mother's from New Mexico, has family going back generations, pre-U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how you deal. I get questions like, or people tell me I should go back to Mexico. And how do you, have you had those kind of situations where people question your Americanness when you go back to pre-American history, and how?
Yeah, we got to go get a response from Kirsten, please.
You know, nobody has ever told me to go back anywhere. Thank goodness. That sounds so painful. I've never been quite sure how to identify. I mean, I think the closest I come to is just saying I'm from Hispanic New Mexico, northern New Mexico. And you're right, it's a very particular community.
The book, Night at the Fiestas, by Kirsten Valdez-Quaid. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
For all of us at KQED, we thank you, our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.